Chapter 21. In early November 1965, Dorothy Kilgallen neared the end of her quest to discover the truth about who assassinated the president and why, and expose those responsible in the book she was writing for Random House. In all likelihood, the timing of Dorothy Kilgallen's death cannot be a coincidence. It occurred within days of telling friends she possessed evidence revealing what she believed to be the truth. This revelation was likely the last straw on the camel's back for those involved in the assassination and prompted them to immediately assemble a plan to murder her. Inside information fed, as will be shown, to those who feared Kilgallen and caused panic. She was too close to the truth. Whoever snitched on her, whoever betrayed her trust, must have triggered a call to action. Kilgallen's second New Orleans trip must never happen. This proposed trip warrants close examination. During the prior visit, something occurred based on Mark Sinclair's mysterious account, Kilgallen asking him to return to NYC and not ask any questions about her JFK probe, to spook Kilgallen, but it was not enough to make her stop the investigation. Instead, the fearless journalist forged ahead with increasing motivation. Evidence she expected to receive in New Orleans may have been the coup de grace, the key to finding any missing pieces about the assassinations. Recall that in the DA to link Ruby to Oswald column, Kilgallen suggested that Oswald may have actually worked in Ruby's nightclub. In the days and months that followed, it appears she had somehow further connected them. If she was then able to solidify the link between Oswald and Marcello, the risk of traveling to New Orleans would be worth it. Why? Because that link fit perfectly in view of the connection she had established between Marcello and Ruby, perhaps through the interview with Ruby, providing the smoking gun evidence she would present in articles on her upcoming book. Kilgallen needed to obtain the final proof she needed to connect all three men, with Marcello as the mastermind of the mob operation to kill JFK. Apparently, if she could obtain this proof from the source whom I do not know but will recognize who is going to give me information about the case, she mentioned to What's My Line makeup man Carmen Gebbia, she would indeed have the scoop of the century, as she once boasted. Targeting Marcello as the one who had the strongest motive to orchestrate the murder of Kilgallen is easier than proving how she was murdered. Nevertheless, the means by which she was killed is connected to the opportunity to commit the crime. Exposing both means and opportunity requires revisiting the death scene at her townhouse. Mark Sinclair, as first quoted in The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, stands out as the most credible eyewitness. During his videotaped interviews, he recalled entering Kilgallen's home on the morning of November 8th. She had asked him to fix her hair for an appointment she had at Kerry's school. Sinclair said he headed for a small dressing room on the townhouse's third floor where Kilgallen normally had her hair done. This room was next to her main clothes closet leading directly to Kilgallen's master bath. Sinclair recalled, "When I entered, she was not in that room, but the air conditioning was on, and it was cold outside. So I turned on my curling irons, and I walked into the adjacent bedroom, not thinking she would be there." Author's note, temperatures in New York City in November 1965 hovered near the freezing point. In those days, there was no central air conditioning. Each room had a wall or window unit. That bedroom was the master. It was adjacent to the black room, where the couple entertained guests. The couple had not slept in the master bedroom for some time. Sinclair, in a separate audio-taped interview, said Kilgallen was lonely, really lonely, and she proceeded to tell me the situation that occurred in the master bedroom she no longer slept in, which I had often asked why she didn't use that bedroom since it was so much more convenient. Sinclair, when asked if this was the bedroom where she caught Richard with one of his paramours, apparently a business partner, agreed, stating, And another ironic thing, I thought, was that Dorothy would have never slept there, let alone committed suicide there, or even have a fatal overdose there. She hated that bedroom, and we only used it because of the dressing room, or we would have never used it at all. Sinclair explained that Kilgallen normally slept in her private office, the Kloop, on the fifth floor. Richard slept in a bedroom on the fourth floor. Sinclair further described what he discovered. She was sitting up in bed, and I walked over to the bed and touched her, and I knew she was dead right away. The bed was spotless. She was dressed very peculiarly. I've never seen her dressed like that before. She always was in pajamas and old socks, and her makeup was off, and her hairpiece was off, and everything. She was completely dressed like she was going out. The hair was in place, the makeup was on, the false eyelashes were on. Sinclair added, the matching peignoir and robe, a book laid out on the bed, a drink on the table, the light was on, the air conditioning was on, though you didn't need an air conditioner. You would have had the heat on. And she was always cold. And why she had the air conditioning on, I don't know. The book was The Honey Badger by Robert Ruark, a journalist, author, world traveler, and big game hunter. He was the same Ruark who wrote a column criticizing Frank Sinatra. He said the crooner had frolicked with mobsters during a trip to Havana in 1947. Sinclair, who explained that perhaps someone had turned on the air conditioner to keep the body a certain temperature, said the glass was on the right-hand side, way away, way over, and the book was turned upside down. It wasn't in the right position where, if you'd been reading, you'd lay it down, and it was laid down so perfectly. Sinclair continued to describe the scene. Rigor mortis had set in on one hand, the right hand, and it had drawn up the covers a little bit, and there was lipstick on the left sleeve of the bolero jacket, and the light was on, and she was sitting up. I went back in the dressing room, picked up the intercom, and rang for James, the butler. I said, James, I am unable to wake Miss Kilgallen. Could you please come up? He ran up the stairs. I could hear him. He came up the front stairs, and he ran like he was very excited, and of course the door was locked, but I had come in from the back door. I don't think they expected me. No one knew I was coming. And this was before 9:30 in the morning, 9, 5 after 9. So I opened the door to the bedroom, and James came in, and at that time I noticed a sheet of paper laying on the floor that had been pushed under the door, and James came in, and he was very flustered. He wasn't himself at all. Sinclair's statement regarding Kilgallen wearing a robe with her hair, makeup, and false eyelashes in place, with the covers pulled up, matched the descriptions in the NYC medical examiner's documents, providing credibility for his account. He added, and I was very upset, so I turned to James and I said, I'm going home. You can reach me there if you want to, and I left the building. Sinclair then added, when I got downstairs and went out the front door, there was a police car sitting in front of the house. There were two officers in it, sitting right dead in front of the house. They didn't pay any attention to me when I came out. I find it very strange that they were sitting there dead in front of the house and Dorothy was dead upstairs. Yes, I find it very strange. Asked about being interviewed, Sinclair said, they called me that night, my then press agent, Jan. I can't remember her last name. Anyway, she called me and asked me to come to Romla Metzler's house, and I did. And the two of them interrogated me, basically trying to find out what I knew about Dorothy's death. And I didn't have very much to tell them. He added, but why would they call me? Metzler was a Journal American fashion writer. Shown a newspaper story reporting the maid having discovered the body, Sinclair said, they mixed that all up, but I don't think I was the first one to find Dorothy. I've never thought that. According to Carey's tutor and family companion, Ibn Hassan, who described Kilgallen as articulate, very sociable, polite, and elegant in dress and manner, Sinclair was right. During a November 2015 interview with this author, Dr. Hassan, who enjoyed a stellar career in international politics after earning several PhDs, said, Before I went to class at Columbia around 9 a.m. that Monday, November 8th, I saw all of the servants rushing around the lobby as I was leaving. I asked James what happened. He said, "Dorothy died." Then I left for class. Hassan also stated he did not recall seeing a police car outside Kilgallen's townhouse, lending credence to his having left for class before Sinclair arrived. Hassan attended Kilgallen's funeral, but Sinclair did not. He stated, "Her sister Eleanor called me and asked if I would do Dorothy's hair and makeup because no one knew how to fix her as well as I did. I went to the funeral home, Abbey Funeral Home. I didn't like the funeral director because he was very rude about Dorothy's death." Sinclair added that he went ahead with the work, but then the power failed, there was a total blackout of NYC, and he had to return the next night and finish. Sinclair said he did not attend Kilgallen's funeral because, "I did not like the way they were behaving. I didn't like the way the family was behaving. I didn't like the way the press was behaving. I didn't like any of it. I knew more than they did, and I didn't want to be a party to it." Charles Simpson, Kilgallen's alternate hairdresser, confirmed Sinclair's eyewitness account in a videotaped interview. He recalled that Sinclair called me on the phone and told me that he had found her dead, and he said, "When I tell you the bed she was found in and how I found her," he said, "you're going to know she was murdered." And when he told me, I knew. Simpson added, "When Mark told me that day and then we got back together and he talked to me and told me where he found her and how, it was abnormal. The whole thing was abnormal. It was just abnormal. The woman didn't sleep in that bed, much less the room, and if she still were sharing that room with Richard, that was Richard's bed. That's the one he set fire to. It wasn't her bed." This referred to an earlier incident on December 15, 1953. A drunken Colmer had accidentally set his bed on fire with a lighted cigarette after falling asleep. His screams alerted Kilgallen. She rushed to save him. This episode is confirmed through the aforementioned YouTube video of My Top 10 Dorothy Kilgallen's Moments on What's My Line. Among the quips noted regarding fun times for her on the show is the appearance of Harold Gold, a New York City firefighter. After the panel, including Kilgallen, is stumped, host John Daly introduces Gold by stating, "On the morning of December 15, 1953, Lieutenant Harold I. Gold put out a fire in the home of Miss Dorothy Kilgallen." This certainly was the fire Simpson described. One important note regarding Sinclair's story is the time factor. His recollection, and for that matter Hassan's, that he entered Kilgallen's townhouse between 9 o'clock and 9:30 a.m. and then discovered Kilgallen's body is completely at odds with various newspaper accounts. Proof of Kilgallen being denied a proper investigation of her death consists of four glaring mistakes made on her death certificate. First, her full name was stated as Dorothy Kilgallen Colmer, even though she never used the name Colmer but was known as Dorothy Kilgallen. Second, her last name was misspelled as K-I-L-L-G-A-L-L-E-N instead of K-I-L-G-A-L-L-E-N. Third, her birth date was listed as July 13, 1913, when the correct date was July 3, 1913. And fourth, the document states the time of death was noon, which is completely incorrect. At age 52, Dorothy Kilgallen, called by the New York Post the most powerful female voice in America, and by Ernest Hemingway, the greatest female writer in the world, was dead. Suicide, accident, or murder? Given the circumstances of the death, homicide emerges as the most credible explanation. The sinister forces of deadly enemies had been circling the truth-seeking journalist even before JFK's assassination, including CIA operatives upset with a column she wrote alleging that Radio Free Europe was not free, but instead influenced by subversive groups. This column triggered the CIA's interest in her. A subsequent dossier documented Kilgallen's less-than-cooperative attitude when contacted by agents in search of a source for her column entry. She flatly refused to give up her source, causing the CIA to join the list of her enemies. That list certainly included J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, an accusation confirmed by a column famed journalist Liz Smith wrote titled, "Strange Case of Dorothy Kilgallen," shortly after she died. Smith stated, "The FBI has voluminous material about Kilgallen." Such a statement completely contradicts a United States Department of Justice letter to this author dated April 26, 2017, signed by David M. Hardy, Section Chief, Records Management Division. Regarding an extensive request under the Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, for documents included in Kilgallen's FBI file, Hardy wrote, "We conducted a search of the Central Records System. We were unable to identify main file records responsive to the FOIA." Regarding the CIA, Liz Smith added, "What was this international agency doing investigating a gossip columnist? The CIA has 20-odd pages on Dorothy Kilgallen in its files. It contacted 51 CIA offices in her case." In closing, Smith stated, "Both the FBI and CIA are the shadows of suspicion and clouds of disgrace." Yes, Kilgallen was in the crosshairs of both the CIA and the FBI. She had enemies galore, especially after she began investigating the JFK assassination. During the early 1950s, more than a decade before the Dallas assassinations, and after Kilgallen and husband Richard Colmer discussed Russian movies appearing at a New York theater during their Breakfast with Dorothy and Dick radio program, Richard said he believed many of the Communist Front organizations were allowed to continue operation so the FBI could root out subversives. He surmised that, "In about an hour after the communist meetings, the FBI comes in and they pick up every little scrap of paper, cigarette butts, anything that could be used as evidence." Adding her thoughts, Kilgallen told the radio audience, "They probably take little candid snaps. Now they have cameras the size of cigarette lighters. They can take pictures under all circumstances." Such banter caught the attention of an FBI informant, who quickly called bureau agents in the New York office. The informer described the twosome as idiot-type people and the program as chatter and comments. Immediately, Hoover received a complete transcript of the show under the title "Colmer's Tell How FBI Operates at Radical Meetings." Monitoring Breakfast with Dorothy and Dick became a continuing FBI operation. Author Mark Lane, Rush to Judgment, stated that Kilgallen told him several times, "Intelligence agencies will be watching us. We'll have to be very careful." Unfortunately, she had not been, and this mistake adds to the mystery as to how she was eliminated, just as mysterious elements weaved through the death of Marilyn Monroe.